Back at it at Club 30. I'm your host, Henrik Lundqvist. I'm sitting here with my good old friend, Jay Lydell. How are we doing today?
Great. I'm hungry after that episode.
You're hungry?
I'm always hungry.
You're always hungry. Every time I see you, it's like, I'm so hungry. And we really got into it with today's guest, Marcus Samuelson.
Sports and cooking has been my life since I was a kid. And when I didn't make it as professional soccer player, which was... I would say the biggest setback I've ever had. Like I was so entrenched with being with my team and all of that stuff. And that was, I would probably say, the only time that I was not on this fast-paced track, right? Because it was either soccer, and then when soccer didn't work out, I switched over right away to cooking and took the same kind of camaraderie, work ethic, skills, training, and just moved it into food. And it helped me.
Marcus was incredible. And he's been, you know, kind of a culinary hero of mine for a long time. After the first time I ate at Red Rooster, I ate at Aqua Vitae back in the day, but the Swedes have their, it's particular, you know?
Yes.
And I didn't get used to the Swedish cuisine until many trips over there with you, but
I'm just going to throw it out there. I'm awful in the kitchen. So for me to sit here and listen to him, hopefully I picked up something.
Yeah.
It was more just about his story and mindset about cooking and playing a huge part of, you know, the restaurant world.
Yeah. And you know, whether you've heard it before, this was the first time, his origin story is absolutely incredible. It's crazy.
And he loves what he's doing.
He loves it.
That's where
he's never going to stop.
That's where it starts.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Here it is, our sit down with Marcus Samuelson. He's a world-class chef and a restaurateur, a judge and a host on some of your favorite culinary TV shows. And just like me, he's a Swede living in New York City. Please welcome to Club 30, cooking champion and food guru, Marcus Samuelson.
Thank you for having me.
Great to
welcome.
Have you here, Marcus.
Nice.
You know, both me and Jay, we love food. And one of the reasons why we love New York City is really because of the variety and quality of the restaurants in the city, and you have had ton of success here. But before we get into that, I want to go back in time. All right, you were born in Ethiopia, and your story is pretty wild. Would you mind sharing it with us and the members here at Club 30, some of your early years?
Yeah, no, I'm sure they're very familiar with Swedeopians. It's as common
Swedeopians.
No, but just like you're saying, I was born in a hut in Ethiopia, specifically an hour and a half, 2 hours outside the capital in Addis. And the time when I was born, there was big TB, tuberculosis, definitely in the countryside. And my sister, my mom, and I all had TB. She walked us into the hospital, which is like a several days walk. She passed away, but me and my sister survived. The hospital she took us to was connected with, affiliated with Sweden. And basically one of the nurses there, she said, well, what are we going to do with these two kids, right? And she took us in. She basically brought to the heart to save our life. She just took us home and then eventually set us up with a Swedish adoption agency. And we got adopted. I went from the warmest country in the world to the coldest country in the world. I went from being Kasahunza guy to Marcus Samuelson. But I say that because sometimes the hardest things that happen in life can also be flipped in to the biggest opportunity, right? But we all need luck. And I was extremely fortunate, lucky, but also the fortune of goodness of others. And that's the type of thing that happened in my life so many times. Like if that nurse, she would have just done her job, we would have been healthy. They would have put us back on the street and we would have figured it out. But she said, hey, I just can't do that. I got to figure out a better solution for that. And that has happened to me a couple of times in life. And if you don't have that little extra little level of luck, I think we all need it in life. Especially as a goalie, you need luck.
I mean, that's incredible. So then you grew up in Gothenburg, Sweden, a town I'm very familiar with. That's where I played for many years before I moved to New York.
Egg is a hero in Gothenburg.
Yeah, I've been.
Not just like one of the guys, like a hero in Gothenburg.
Yeah. It's bizarre because he doesn't get interrupted very often, or in a respectful manner, he gets interrupted in New York.
Yeah.
Everybody's busy. But in Gothenburg.
Yeah.
I've been there probably 6 or 7 times now.
Oh, nice.
And they think he's public property.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway.
Or they think I'm Joel, my brother.
Or they think
that
you're Joel.
That happens a lot when I'm in Gothenburg. Joel.
Yeah. Right.
It's like, no, actually, I'm Henry.
That's awesome. Right. That's great. I love that.
It happens
that
a
makes
lot.
Me happy. Go, Joe. Exactly.
Yeah.
You got New York, you got G-Burg. What? Don't complain.
So, how was Gothenburg? You know, that's a big contrast.
Yeah.
Obviously, you were very young, but I want to understand, like, when did the interest of cooking come about?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Gothenburg, but also an hour and a half up north in a fishing village called Smögen that you're familiar with. It's like on the water.
I've been there too.
Do you do all the right stops when you're going?
Thanks to Hank.
I'll take care of him when he's in Sweden.
I had very tiny shrimp in Smögen.
Exactly. Okay. So anyway, so fishing was a big part of our culture. So my uncles were fishermen, and on my father's side, they were all fishermen. And so there was not cooking, but being around food from that sense, and it was a trade, you know, like I fished, we sold the fish, we preserved the fish. And in the city, during the school year, my grandmother was a huge influence, and she was really the major cook in our family. They just lived a couple of minutes away from us, and we used to have 2 dinners at home. We used to eat mom's food, then bike over to grandma's house and have the real dinner. And my mom was always calling, where are they? With me and my 2 sisters. We're always over there eating. But when you went over to grandma's house, it was a very different pace. They were tired, but it was always this vibe. So it was always different. It was my grandfather on the corner listening and screaming at the radio. And then it was my grandmother that had always a season or something going on. Like there was mushroom that needed to be pickled. There was like berries that needed to be cleaned. There was always like a stock cooking in the back. There was like constant, almost like a professional kitchen. My sisters kind of just ate, played and left, but I always stayed with her. And maybe because I was the youngest, I just loved being with my grandmother that much. I didn't even know when I was kind of like sort of working until I was a teenager and you wanted like a weekend job. And I'm like, I can work in a restaurant. And there was like a chef there. It's like, hey, you're much faster than everybody else. And that I kind of like, that was really drove me. But the other big thing for me was being a soccer player. So I'm like, sports and cooking has been my life since I was a kid. And when I didn't make it as a professional soccer player, which was, I would say, the biggest setback I've ever had. Like, I was so entrenched with being with my team and all of that stuff. And that was, I would probably say, the only time that I was not on this fast-paced track, right? Because it was either soccer, and then when soccer didn't work out, I switched over right away to cooking and took the same kind of camaraderie, work ethic, skills, training, and just moved it into food. And it helped me because I think being a teenager with a lot of energy, I needed to have something that I was super focused on.
But at what point did you decide cooking is your calling?
Pretty much right after I got cut from soccer. You know, as a professional athlete, there is no, you train 6 days, 7 days a week, sometimes 2 days. It was not that this is not going to work. And then when that happened, I was like, it was such a shock to my system. It's like, I was really worried. What am I going to do? Like, I was like, what? And socially, it was really too weird for me too, because all my friends was in that whole thing. So once this opportunity with being a chef, I started focus on it more. It was almost easier than soccer in a way, but it would take the same amount of hours. And then I met people that told me that this is a career. I didn't even know it was a career.
You know,
as a teenager, I was like something you did and you made a little money.
Yeah.
And then I got a chance to go to Japan pretty early in my life to study, and then to Switzerland. And once I got to Switzerland, it was like big league, right? Because the main language was French. It was not English anymore. It was German or French, and I had to like manage that. And just like any other craft, there was a highest level, which was 3-star Michelin in France, which I always wanted to work at. And it took me a couple of years, and eventually I got to a 3-star Michelin in France. And as a Swedish kid, being in France, I just felt like I reached Mount Everest. I felt it was just such a sense of arrival, like, oh, wow, I actually have a resume here that I can work anywhere in the world, you know?
Speaking of anywhere in the world, eventually you end up in New York City. you're deeply connected to the city, and especially Harlem. Like, what drew you to New York City?
You know, I think identity is big, right? And I think when you grow up adopted, cross-race, sort of identity, race, culture, where do you fit in? You know, for any kid, it's hard to grow up, whoever you are. But then you add layers to it, that makes it even more complex, right? And race and identity was always there, kind of as a roommate in certain situations, almost, right? You're in France, and, you know, it's kind of brutal. And I remember the last day in France, you know, now worked professionally like 6-7 years. I'm 23 years old. And I speak to the chef, and the chef doesn't even look up. He's like, okay, go home to your parents, come back in 1 month. And I got a new job for you in Cannes. It's also 3-star. But these jobs, it's like you're working, but you don't get paid. I've now done that for 6-7 years, got supported by my parents. And I'm like, I got to stop this. I got to support myself. Like, this is not, I can't do this anymore. It's not fair to them. It's not fair to anybody. So I said, chef, I can't. I'm actually going to say no to the job. I'm going to start to open my own restaurant. Not today, but eventually my goal is to open a restaurant just like yours. And he just said to me in French, like, Papa Sib, it's not possible. And it's like, what do you mean it's not possible? And then he's like, just very straight. Didn't even raise his voice. He said, listen to me, girl. As a black kid, you can work in a restaurant, but you can't own a restaurant. What do you mean? Like, I'm at the highest level. He's like, do you know any black chef that owns a restaurant in France? And I'm like, I only been to Paris once, and I've been here for a year. I don't know everybody in France. He's like, I can explain this for you. None. Do you know anyone in Europe? I'm like, I don't know everybody in Europe, but probably not. But for me, I looked at that as an opportunity. I was like, so what? Like, I'm doing this, and this is my goal, right? He said, it's not going to happen for you. I don't know what to tell you. You need to change your goal. And you know, like when somebody tells you to lower your goal, it's like, good luck. And I'm also very fortunate. I have two parents that were always supporting me. When I went home, I knew I had my dad and my mom that I can consult and really talk to. My father, you know, great professional. He had a geology company. And so he didn't know cooking, but he knew kind of how the world in certain business world would work. He said, go to New York. Can you get a job in New York? And I got a job in Restaurant Aqua Vit. And I said, yeah, I can get a job anywhere. I had these papers. I can get a job anywhere. I faxed over my stuff. They said, when can you start? This is awesome for us. And I was like, well, can you get my U.S. green card? I said, no problem. It will take 2 years to get a green card. All that. I was like, great. And I came to New York as a sous chef. I was number two in the kitchen. Eventually became a chef and loved it right away. And just like that New York bug that we all have, right? You either like it.
Yeah.
Or it's like, you're not going to make it.
It's yet. A tour of duty for some.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. How long had Aqua Vit been open before you shoot there?
It's been open for about 5 years or so. And it was like, it was a nice, very respectable Swedish restaurant. It had 1-star New York Times at the time when I worked there. And eventually when I took over, it became a 3-star New York Times restaurant, which just changed everything.
Was there any specifics that led to that? Like, what was it about your cooking or your style of work that made that happen?
Well, I think, first of all, the restaurant was a great restaurant, whether I was there or not. It was just, for me, I thought it was easier to work because now I didn't have to work in French. I could work in English, which was, for me, it's like a huge upside. And then it was just about implementing the work ethic and understanding of ingredients that I've done for 6 years, but really run it through my own lens. So I felt like I can do this. Like, there's no doubt I cannot do. Like, let's go, you know? And, I mean, I'm asking, like, even throw it back to you, going from, at that point, the Elitserien to NHL, how big was the gap? I always wonder that because that's next level, right? How big was the gap for you?
Well, it was definitely a big gap, but a lot of it is in your head, too. How much bigger do you make it in your head? It's still the same game.
Yeah.
It's still the same preparation.
Yeah.
But you are facing more quality, right?
Yeah.
The quality of the shooters, the speed of the game, the intensity of the game, it goes up. I think that balance of like, okay, your dream is coming true and you're playing with all these big stars, but in a way you have to make it normal to you to feel comfortable in that situation,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I think it, you know, hockey and sports is pretty objective, right? You win a lot. And it's very easy to measure what a win looks like. But for Marcus, it's more subjective. Like, what is taste? And so there's like a definition of what all that experience feels like in Europe, which is like the Michelin system. But there's another different version or description of that over here, which, it, you know, has started to be tied to the Michelin system, but maybe not. You know, so it's a more subjective.
It is. And I think what makes food so exciting in America is because food exists on so many different levels here. Like, you can go to a food truck and have a wonderful meal. You can eat at a Michelin star rated restaurant. You can go to a noodle shop. Henrik likes ramen, for example, right? And, you know, there are tons of ramen shops here. And the diversity of what a city like New York City can offer, and who's to say what's best, right? That's the interesting thing. But there are things that we all can taste. All of us can taste sweet, sour, salt, bitter, and umami. And umami is probably the one, from a Western point of view, that we have the least understanding of. But umami has been around just as long as taste has been around. Uh-huh. So aged Parmesan cheese has umami. Miso soup, of course, has umami. Anything fermented has umami, right? How do we taste? We taste it through texture. If you don't like an oyster, it's not the oyster you don't like. It's the texture of the oyster, right? And aesthetic. If the croissant is one day old, it doesn't stand up the same way. You're like, no, I don't want that. It's kind of separate, softened down a little bit. So aesthetic is very, very important for us. And then last one, fragrance. If things are not smelling right to us, we're very, very sensitive to that. Most of our flavor point for us as humans are not associated with our tongue, are actually with through our nose, right? So these sort of eight building blocks, it's not owned by chefs, it's for everybody. But as a chef, you have a higher learning and understanding on how to get to it, right? And then we use our techniques, high heat, the steam, the theater, all of that to get to it. So that's really our strongness.
I remember last time I was up at Red Rooster, you were hosting the Swedish Prime Minister. We were a bunch of Swedes there enjoying the full experience. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And now you being so rooted up in Harlem with different places, like talk to us about a night out up in Harlem, Red Rooster.
Yeah.
Like, where are we going?
Yeah.
What are we doing?
We're going to see the aunts and the aunties first. Like when I leave my house on the corner, there's a French little great wine bar where we gather and we have a glass of wine, walk across the street. We're going to see Mr. Dapper Dan. He's on the corner teaching the young kids about how to be entrepreneurs. We're going to meet someone like Bevy Smith. That's going to, she doesn't walk on the boulevard. She like strolls them. She has a hat on. We go to Red Rooster. We eat. We listen to great music. You know, I might take you to a late spot called Good Good. Good Good is a little Jamaican spot. Or we might go to Shrine, which is like a Nigerian little after hours. It's just people are everywhere. And it's such a lively neighborhood, whether there's been a concert at the Apollo, or whether it's been a show at the Studio Museum. And it's, you know, one of these mystique places, like why you come to New York for. I feel like Chelsea has that. Brooklyn has that. There's these areas in New York, Bronx. It's like it's such a New York thing to do. And it's also why I love the city. You know, you don't have to be in one place.
Totally. Given your kind of intentionality on where you open and why you do it, have you seen the pull through, you know, you're an icon in the culinary world, but you're also an icon in the black world too. But you did it and they can see you.
No, I mean, I always feel, first of all, as an immigrant to this country, enormous amount of gratitude. Like all three of us are immigrants.
Yeah.
And to be able to sit here and do what we love to do, you know, sometimes I pinch myself when I drive back from Kennedy Airport or, you know, LaGuardia or whatever, and it's like, oh, I live in this place, right? So that gratitude of being able to do something that you love in a city that you love and express yourself and have people come and support it, the work around it can be frustrating because you deal with people and some stuff doesn't work, always work out the way you want to. But as a whole, it's hella inspiring. Now, the people I work with are very inspiring to me. And for me, I'm always more comfortable around the arts, whether it's musicians or chefs or painters or designers. So that's kind of my hub. And then the business part of it, it's something that I learned. And I partner with people because, you know, we run a pretty significant business in seven or eight countries. But I would never be like, see myself as, oh, I'm a businessman and here's my bag. You know what I mean? Like that's how I see myself. I see myself as a chef that care about my communities, you know, as a person of color, as a black person. I hope I can be a shining light for anyone who come from a basic background and have the desire to go and get it. You know, when I was coming up, there wasn't a lot of chefs I could look up to. So I remember looking at Jean-Michel Basquiat, like a street artist. I was like, that's so cool that he could do that, you know, or looking at very often at athletes and like, wow, this guy is really standing out. And I always looked at those guys, whether they were shorter, you know, I'm older than you guys. So for me, like looking at someone like Diego Maradona was not the athlete type, right? But just, I just adored him because he just changed the game, you know?
Yeah. I can tell you, you're having a huge impact. And I was traveling the other day. I was having lunch and this waitress overheard me speaking Swedish. So she asked me where I'm from.
Yeah.
And she happened to be from Ethiopia.
Oh, nice.
She was a chef and a waitress. So I told her, listen, in a few days, I'm going to sit down with a very good chef from Ethiopia. And she looks at me, starts smiling, Marcus? And I'm like, yeah, Marcus.
Yeah.
And I just have to tell you, like, she was so grateful for what you've done and put Ethiopia and food, really put it out there. It was just really cool to see.
Thanks.
How much she appreciated you and what you've done and the impact you've had.
No, I mean, that's what you do it for, moments like that, right? And you feel like representation matters, right?
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think that we live in a society where, you know, you get your news through your phone and it's very harsh and people live kind of through their tunnel visions. I feel like food and breaking bread is one of those places where you can meet other people, where you can actually look up in your day and be like, oh, that guy with that set across the bar there, whatever, that's amazing. Or I've never, you know, like that's really for me where New York restaurants are so amazing. When you walk into a place and you actually get energy, like, people don't come to our restaurants to eat because they're hungry. They come to the restaurant to be social and also feel something, be part of something, right? Because everyone works hard. Everyone is tired. But when they come to the restaurant, it's like it's going to watch a game, right? You feel like playing without an audience, I'm sure matters, but playing with an audience. Look, I remember the first time I went to see you at the Garden, right? To hear 18,000 people scream, Hank, it's like, holy shit. And you could have won the game without the audience, but that experience. And I was really thinking about because I've been to many, many hockey games, love hockey, but I've never have had that experience with someone that I know. And I was like, the kick that I got, I'm like, imagine to be the subject of that. It was unbelievable. But how did you handle like that? Because that's even different than being in Sweden where you know, people are excited, but Madison Square Garden is the most famous arena in the world.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, very important when you're in this city. You want to enjoy it,
but
at the same time, you have to stay on course, right? Because it's so easy to get off the rails a little bit when you have a lot of people, you know, pulling you in different directions or telling you different things. I think it's so important just to stay focused on what you need to do. But yeah, of course you enjoy those moments.
Yeah.
You know, to have that connection with the crowd, that's something that's very rare. And as an athlete, something you will miss.
Yeah.
That I will miss, you know, to be out there and playing in front of so many people and to have that connection and doing something that means so much to so many people, you know, that was a great feeling.
Well.
But does it change when you're competing in cooking versus when you're at home or cooking in a restaurant? Or do you have the exact same mindset?
No. I love competing because it's you know, the athletes in me just love that process. And a lot of chefs don't, right? They're amazing chefs, but they don't think about it through that adrenaline rush. I know I have that competitive advantage very often. So when it really matters, I never get nervous cooking on TV like that because I know, like, yo, this is not even about you. I'm going this way. And 9 times out of 10, it's going to work out. So I like actually competing more than judging, because sometimes when you judge, you also have to realize it's not really about you. It's judging their plate. And when you judge, you're like, you think about, oh, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have done that. But then once you're a really good judge, you have to kind of evolve to, like, how do you see what they were doing, trying to achieve? And how do you coach them so if they're going to stay to the next round, that they kind of have some toolbox so they can do it even better in the next round?
And judging, does that help you become a better contestant in a competition? Because now you're sitting on the other side, right? Trying to understand what they're looking for, right?
No, but I think, like, in anything, you have to... It's all about love for the craft. And one of the things, what's great watching sport, right, when you have a former athlete talking about it, because there is a respect there right away. This person knows not just the technicality of the sports, but actually, what is that, Shona Sequoia, what does that moment feel like that you can't touch? Like, you know, as an audience, you can learn a lot, but you don't know what it feels like unless you've been in those shoes. And the same thing in cooking. It's like, it's a lot about techniques. It's a lot about staying calm and being in your space, but then you got to execute. And a lot of people can have it in their head, have the idea, but then they freeze up once that camera or the clock, and that they can't execute on because of either the camera or the time, right? But they're amazing chefs, and you give them, you know, another 45 minutes and they create amazing food. So TV cooking is not for everyone.
Yeah. But being a great cook, do you need to be good to handle stress? I feel like every time I look into a kitchen, when I'm at a restaurant, it's like, ooh, it's stressful in there. Like, they're like, people are yelling and they're sweating and they're running around.
Yeah.
Like, do you need to feel good about the stress in a way?
But I think it's like when you go to a TV studio, right? The director is, if you're an outsider looking at it, you wonder why is this guy screaming at everybody? He's actually not screaming at everybody. It's just the rhythm. You're a conductor, basically. And everyone in that crew knows what needs to happen. But from an outsider looking in, it looks crazy. And I mean, you've been around coaches that have tried different approaches, and you know which approach works best for your team at that moment.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So Marcus, you achieved so much. You received a lot of different awards. You've been on different shows, like we talked about. And you also had an opportunity to cook for Obama.
Yeah.
At the White House. How was that experience? And I want to know, like, was there a lot of restrictions in terms of what you could do? Take us through.
Yeah.
You're showing up to the White House to cook.
Yeah.
Like, what's your game plan here?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the process even before that, there was a lot of tryouts. You have to first write a menu. And then I knew it was for Prime Minister Singh of India, and he was vegetarian. So I knew, like, there's going to be an opportunity to really do a vegetarian forward menu. And it was also around the time where the former First Lady Michelle Obama started her garden project. So I'm like, let's be inspired by that garden. And those were kind of the pillars that I wanted to write it around. And studied, like, up until that point, state dinners were mainly French. And I'm like, that's weird. Like, that wouldn't make sense if it's a French prime minister. But so I'm like, what's the combination? If I would invite Prime Minister Singh to our house, we would do something that is on brand of him being vegetarian, showcasing both Indian ingredients and American ingredients, because that's like how you welcome someone as a guest. So that was kind of the framework of the menu. Then leading up to it, I wasn't nervous. Things changed. Like, a lot of tests had to get done. But then the dinner got so big, so the kitchen moved out to the lawn. And I was like, this is different, right? How does the food stay warm? We're now cooking in a tent versus a regular kitchen to regular dining room. There was a lot of logistics there.
Yeah.
And you said, it's going to be four courses. You have 44 minutes. Go. Not 45. And I was like, you're on a clock like this. But I'll tell you a funny part about it. Like, that afternoon, you know, I called my mom. I didn't want to call my mother before that. Called my mom's like, listen, if you hear about it in Swedish news tomorrow, I just want you to know this for me first. And, you know, I'm going to cook this big dinner for the president. And my mom goes quiet. She's like, Marcus, you're not going to like this. But I think it's better if you leave. If you leave now, people are going to get upset with you. But if you poison the president of the United States, You will never have a chance to come back. So I think it's better you just drop your knives and leave. And I'm like, what? Thank you, Rob.
What a vote of confidence.
What?
Yeah.
I was like, click, not doing that.
But how long was the preparation going into this? Was weeks or even months?
No, week. I mean, we started in, the dinner was in November, I want to say.
Yeah.
And we started in August with like, coming up with the ideas, and they coming up with the tastings and back and forth. But, you know, a couple of years later, the Obamas came to Harlem to our restaurant, and that was more a celebration because I'm like, now I got home court advantage.
Right.
But, you know, I'd be fortunate to cook for a lot of U.S. presidents, cooked for Clinton many, many times, cooked for him in Sweden when he traveled to Sweden, and cooked for President Bush Sr., rest in peace. So having sort of experience of cooking for presidents I've had, but the state dinner for Obama was the first one at the White House. And I learned a lot of this process actually cooking for the Swedish royal family because the process is very similar, right? You can't talk about the menu. Out of safety, you very often don't talk about where this dinner is going to be. And it can also change up until like 1 hour before because, you know, a world incident can happen and it changed like that. You know?
You better be on your toes.
Yes, right. You're ready. And you're walking around with this information and you can't even tell your significant others because this is like info that you can't talk about.
Obviously, you're so talented in cooking. And I know before I came here to the studio, I asked my wife, like, is there anything you want me to ask Marcus? I still think that she hopes that someday I'm going to be able to cook. I'm just terrible in the kitchen. I'm sitting here thinking about, like, what should I ask Marcus that could help me jumpstart this broken machine?
Yeah.
Usually I get to do the dishes at home,
great.
Right? So that's my role. Sometimes I do cut the veggies.
Yeah.
That's about it. But, I mean, do you have any advice for me, for people that not very good in the kitchen to get going?
I think you should cook with your kids because now it's fun and it's great for them to see that maybe they're better than the dad at something. You know, it's a great leveler of just hanging out. And, you know, dishes that work great is very often like something like pizzas where you can like cut the veggies, whatever you want, just put on the toppings. Like for me, taking the stress of making a perfect dish away, but actually the joy of going to maybe the farmer's market together, talking about, you know, on Saturday, we're going to do this pizza thing or whatever it is. What should the toppings be? So for me, it's really around the, it's not the meal itself necessarily only. It's really like the event, right? And then they're going to love that because they're hanging out with you.
Yeah.
And then the cooking is kind of like less important than what you cook, but the why you cook is more important. And making that dad-kids time, because they're going to love that. No.
That's a great advice.
I've seen you cook some cupcakes with
Charlize. Kids. Yeah, we've been baking a few times with the kids.
Yeah.
They love that. Yeah. Maybe I can transition into food now with
and
the kids.
I never ask you this. Growing up as a goalie, who was your favorite goalie? Like, who was your favorite, or maybe not goalie, who was your favorite? Like, this is the guy that I admire so much.
Well, my first idol was Peter Lindmark. Pekka.
Yeah, of course. Pekka. Yeah.
So this is...
He never played in NHL, right?
No, he didn't. But he was probably the best goalie in Sweden at the time, late 80s,
when
I started playing hockey. And then eventually I started watching the NHL, and it was Patrick Roy, Dominik Hasek.
Yeah.
Those were the two guys that watched a lot. But you remember back then, it was hard to find video, you know, before internet, before YouTube, or now, you know, all the kids have iPads and can watch all the clips.
It
back
used
then,
to be trading cards, right? Like you connected to your hero with cards.
Yeah. Right. Know? But in terms of actually footage,
right,
it was like every Saturday for a half hour NHL Power Week. I remember growing up that was the opportunity you had to watch them. But those were definitely my heroes. And what about for you?
Yeah.
Like, in terms of chefs that had an impact, inspired you?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, Marc-Pierre White in London, you know, first of all, he wasn't French, which was important for me because I've been yelled at so many times by the French guys, so anyone but French. But, you know, he had long hair. He smoked. I was like, I don't smoke, but I was like, how cool is this guy? Like, what is this young guy at the point in time having a Michelin-rated restaurant in London. I'm just like, this guy. And he just opened up the door that you don't have to be from France. Wolfgang Puck, like I knew about Wolfgang being European, made in America. I was like, who the hell is this guy? I was always, this for me, it's like such a big move, you know? So coming here, it was a lady, Leah Chase. She just passed away a couple of years ago. She was 95 years old. The first integrated restaurant in America, in New Orleans, like started, the black woman starting her business in the 40s. I'm like, what a rock star.
What was your restaurant in New Orleans?
It's called Duke Chase. It's still there. Yeah. If you go, you should definitely go. It's just like iconic place. And then this gentleman passed away too. It was very helpful to me, Charlie Trotter in Chicago. And he took a liking to me when I got here, and he helped me out a lot. He mentored me. He sent me chefs. He brought me on to events that I got to meet, sort of the big guys, Alain Ducasse, Fran Adrià. I met all these people. And so pretty early I was in the room. I wasn't the main guy in the room, but I was in the room. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is happening. And I learned a lot from just watching these guys and took notes, you know, and loved that experience. And like, okay, this is how it works.
You're coming about Trotter. It must be like a pretty interesting ecosystem. There's like a free agency of chefs, right?
Yeah.
So when you like somebody and trust somebody, you're apt to recommend them to your friend.
Yeah, and also like me sending guys to them, right?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
You know, Trotter was the guy for a long time, and me sending Leon Cook to Trotter, getting that person back a year later, improved my kitchen. So it's very much this mentor program that still exists, you know, and obviously now you have the likes of Danielle, Jean-Georges, Eric, but also a lot of women. And that's what I think is cool about our industry, is transforming right in front of us and on all levels. And I, you know, just what's happening in women's sports is very much setting what's happening also through the work life experiences as well, right? So watching the Women's World Cup where it's sold out, or, you know, being an Arsenal fan, the women played a couple of days ago, sold out. And this type of thing, you know, you watch women's basketball, college, like, sold out stadiums. I'm like, yes. So this is happening all over, which is really, really cool.
Yeah.
No.
And you touched on Arsenal. You're a huge Arsenal fan, right?
Like, are you like a crazy fan?
I love Arsenal. I just love.
Why?
Why? Many reasons, actually. Swedes didn't break into Premier League easily. And they brought in a Swedish guy very early in the 90s, Anders Limpar. And eventually they brought in Fredrik Ljungberg. And Freddie really, really played in Arsenal at the best Arsenal team ever, you know, to have a Swedish guy to not just play in the league, but actually be a star with Thierry Henry and Patrick Vieira and all that stuff. For me, it was just like this unbelievable. So I was always just watching Freddie like this, a Swedish guy. And then obviously Zlatan changed everything, because we never had a rock star in soccer until Zlatan came about.
Yeah,
good players, but he was like top 10 in the world, you know?
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about fashion.
Yeah.
So every time I see you, you have colorful clothes, and I feel like it's always matching you and your personality. You always have a big smile on, always this great energy.
Yeah.
What does fashion mean to you?
So I know very little about fashion. My wife knows a lot about fashion, but I don't. So I love style. I think there's a separation between fashion and style. Like, style for me is very connected to your personality. Everyone has a style.
Yeah.
And as men, very often, we struggle kind of finding our style, whatever that is. But I embrace, like, style, because it, for me, it has to do with attitude. And why I'm drawn to someone is very often through their style, right? Because you don't know that person. You don't meet that person. So, you know, like, when I watch something, I'm like, that guy got crazy hair. I love that guy. You know what I mean? Whatever, it's a style,
right?
And you know, also with street culture and hip-hop and stuff like that. And I love the time they're in right now, because people are allowed to have, they should be allowed to have their own style.
No doubt.
I think it comes also coming from Sweden, where we kind of taught to be, everybody's going to be the same. And then you have this little black kid that you just look at any picture from a school picture, I stand out when I walk.
Right.
Like, you know,
whether
now,
you're in a
suit
or.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So for my parents, was always embrace that style, you know?
Yeah.
And being the youngest, I had two older sisters, I always got their passed down clothes, which, like, I still, like, I don't know what's women's clothing or men's clothing. I don't care. And, like, if I like it, I like it, you know? So I think it's all of that combined. It's just like, laugh at it. Don't take it too seriously. have fun with it.
I love that. And this city is so good that way too, where you just allow people to be whoever they want to be and how they want to be, and the way you dress or how you act. It's like everything feels normal, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm back home in Sweden, I would maybe turn around sometimes if I see a crazy outfit here. Yeah. I'm like, that's New York.
Absolutely. You kind of be like, this
is normal.
Yeah. And you embrace the weird, right? Like, I don't know. That's what makes you a New Yorker versus a transient kind of worker here. Is that when you think like, this is the best, like there's this, like, look at that guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish I had the balls to walk around just like that. I think that every single day.
Henry, when you watch kind of like where hockey is today, you know, basketball went to China early and now it's in Africa and really can challenge soccer being the biggest sport in the world. Where do you see hockey is going? Do you feel like there is a continent or there's another play where we can, is there a team in Mexico City at some point? Like, what do you think? What's the
goal? I hope.
Yeah.
You know, as a player and as a fan of the game, I want hockey to be as big as possible.
Yeah.
I think the Olympics is a huge platform to grow in the sport. I know that the league is, you know, for the last 10, 12 years had opening games over in Europe.
Oh, that's cool. That's great. Yes.
I know a couple of teams are going to Australia to open up next year just for exhibition games.
Yeah.
But stuff like that
matters
and it helps growing the game. But you really have to take advantage of when everybody's watching. And that's why I think it's so important to have the best players play in the Olympics, because it's a huge platform and you will have people watching the game that not necessarily watch it normally, but because they root for their country, they will tune in.
Yeah. Hockey and the culinary world may have the same challenges, which is like there's a top-down one, which is get all the stars very visible, tell their stories. But then there's a bottom-up one, which is like, hockey's expensive. How do I become a chef as a kid?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, I'm just laughing because my nephew, and I love my nephew, but you know, he's my nephew's actually. Right, it's like 1 year, he was playing because of Henrik, he was a goalie, right? Okay. So I got him the pads, we got the whole outfit, and I had to ship it from New York to Sweden, so I shipped it over, and then, you know, he's like, I don't know why you sent me all this stuff, like, I'm not a goalie anymore. And I was like,
Do you understand how much this cost?
That was like last month.
Yeah.
Talking about, I'm not a goalie anymore. I was like, great. It's going to be 14. You can just change your mind.
Right.
I think so I was just like, but, you know, it's a lot of storytelling. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of inspiration around it. And you always root for the little guy, like, whatever that is. Like, I love the fact that Sweden as a country still producing great players that can play in a town. Like, that's amazing, right?
Yeah.
Like, that journey that you think about Börje Salming and that generation really planted and then was sort of handed to another Håkan Loeb and Mats Näslund and then over to Peter and Mats and then over to you. And, you know, that's a relay of guys that really, you know, Niklas, of course, and all of those guys, right? And now, still to this day, we have top defensemen in the league. Like, we're all these things.
Yeah.
It's pretty incredible that, because in other sports, like in tennis, we were very, very highly rated in Sweden, of course. But then golf took that momentum away from us. And, you know, we don't produce the same tennis players anymore as we did. But hockey never stopped.
But I think it's important to have people that inspire, right? From where you're from, or maybe sometimes the way you look.
Yeah.
You know, thinking back of to the impact you've had, many, the woman I met the other day, and it's like, Marcus can do it, why not me? And the same goes in sports, you know? You see these players make it from a small country, and it's like, it builds up this vision, the dreams that it's possible, right?
Yeah.
So,
I just started to follow this young goalie in Sweden now, Liv. He's like, was like MVP, like it's like 18.
Of the U18 tournament, the world champs?
I think he won. Liv is his last name. His father was a goalie. And like this kid, I was like, okay, I'm going to follow him now. And hopefully he can make it, you know, become.
I played with his dad.
Yeah.
Oh, so you know.
Yeah, I know. But he passed in a plane crash.
Oh, my gosh.
In, probably over 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now. Yeah.
Oh.
When he played in Russia.
Yeah.
But his son is very talented.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to follow.
Which is an absolute.
To follow.
Yeah, give him a shout out to the pod so everybody can Google him. which is his name?
Liv, L-I-M. Liv is a hockey goalie in Sweden. And, you know, I connected to Henrik right away. Like, but, you know, you don't want to put pressure on a young guy.
Sure. No.
But I was just like, you root in knowing that his father passed away.
So
all of Sweden roots for this kid. And he doesn't need more pressure, but he's doing great.
Yeah.
And you just root for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Before we finish up here, I just want to know, with everything you accomplished and done, and the TV shows and great restaurants, is there anything left that you feel like I haven't done that? Or do you feel like wherever you are right now, just continue that road?
I love it so much. I have so much fun. Working with younger people just inspires me. Because the way I was raised, the way I was told, you know, I basically had like, remember Tishona, the coach for the Russian team, constantly screaming at you, right? And they produced a great product. But then now cooking is a little bit more Phil Jackson. Like there is a little bit more
Zen
through it, right? And the fact that these young professionals that I work with showing me that there's another way to get the same product, because at the end of the day, isn't that what you want? You want to create a result in the end. So I'm enjoying so much growing with the team, putting them in positions that they can grow for their family and become entrepreneurs. And, you know, it's crazy because when you turn on the news, you think constantly the world is so upside down, right? War in Ukraine, famine, and people hating each other in the political scene. But I just work really hard on cut a lot of that noise out and just go to work and work through joy, because the pandemic really sat us all down in a way. Can we all do this again? Will people ever come to the games again? Will food matter? Will sport matters? And once we get on the other side, for me, it was very important. It's like, no. It was almost taken away from us. You're coming back to this, you're coming back with joy. Do not come back jaded. Don't come back angry face. No one cares. If you're not ready to come back, sit out. If you're coming back, come back with joy. Have a message. And that really what Hal Maher and Red Rooster would try to embody, like joy, you know, because it's not a Democrat or Republican side of joy. You got to all be for joy.
No doubt.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when restaurants shut down and suddenly they start opening up again, and how great it felt to be out again, and also not take it for granted, like the joy of sitting out at a great place, enjoying a meal, meeting people. We started this show talking about why we love this city. Having a great meal with friends and also meeting people is awesome. And a huge part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And Marcus, you're playing a big part of that. So thank you so much for coming
on
the show. Always
what a
great
pleasure
to see you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank
really
you.
Really appreciate being here. And keep doing what you guys are doing, because you inspire people. And I think next year we'll do it in one of my restaurants so I can at least feed you guys.
I was waiting for that.
That's
That's a great invite.
Yeah. All right.
I would love to do it any one of the restaurants you'd have us at. So let's do it.
Thank you, fellas.
Thank you, Marcus.
This was fun.
Thanks again to Marcus Samuelson taking the time to sit down with us. That was awesome. I really enjoyed it. What was your favorite part?
I didn't realize he brought a lot of competitiveness into his kitchen. I just assumed that because he was a huge star, he was recruited to be on these competitions. But I loved the fact that he loved to bring competition into the kitchen.
Yeah, I also loved talking about cooking at the White House.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of challenges and talking about being on your toes.
Yeah. The funniest part might have been his mom telling him to just leave the country before poisoning the president.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for listening and watching. We'd love to have you as Club 30 members. So please like, subscribe, leave a rating if you think what Hank and I are doing is okay. We'd love to have you as members. So thanks so much, and on to the next episode.
Till next time. See you guys.